Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We launched Talking Volumes Season 2019 with an emotional and revealing conversation with writer Alice Hoffman. Her new novel, The World That We Knew, draws on her interest in wartime history, magic, and the stories that her grandmother told her when she was a child. Here's Alice Hoffman.
You know, my grandmother was among those people who escaped from Russia. Mm-hmm. And actually, her father, the story is that he was in the Tsar's army for 20 years until he finally shot off his toes so that he could escape.
Really?
Yeah. I guess if you had no toes, you couldn't march, and that was the end of that.
Wow.
But she was really, for me, the most important person in my life. And I think grandparents are so important, and I feel so lucky to have had her. And I really feel like she helped me to be a writer in so many different ways.
How? Tell me a bit about when she would tell you the story of her life.
She would tell me the stories. Yeah, we'd be on the bus in New York City, and she'd be telling me stories about Russia. And it's just New York fell away, and I just felt like I was with her in Russia.
The family lore that she would share with you sounds like, when I was reading about your descriptions of this, sounded like part folktale, some magic, some supernatural, some real history of the family. How did it sound?
Well, you know, I taped her. I have like
you
an
did?
Hour of her, but I waited too long. So if you're going to do that, don't wait too long, because she couldn't remember the names of anything. And now I can't remember the names of anything. So I get it. But I think it's a great idea to actually interview older members of your family, and to hand it down to your children and their children. I think it's a real treasure to have.
Where is that tape today?
It's somewhere in my attic.
And how long has it been since you listened to it?
A long time. You know, I think, you know, I'm very emotional about her, so I don't know. It'd be hard for me to watch it again.
What do you think was the impulse to tape her? I mean, what do you think was behind that?
I think I wanted to just capture her, you know, for a little bit, just for an hour, just to have her there.
And yet, there it sits in a box somewhere.
Well, you know what? She's with me every day that I write.
Is she?
Yeah.
Okay,
every day.
How?
Well, I feel that, you know, all of her stories and our relationship informs everything that I do, including in this new book.
For sure.
And I didn't even realize it until I was finished writing it, how much she was in there.
And why?
Well, I think part of what this novel's about is the importance of family and what it's like to lose your family. So I think she just was with me so much more during the writing of this book.
One of the things that you've talked about is how you come to understand the idea of fable and mythology, and how, I guess the way I think of it is the way the border lines are porous.
Yeah.
That there's an easy mixing of this idea of mythology and real life and the supernatural and fables. But I'd like to know how you think of that in the conception of this novel and some of the other writing that you've done.
Well, you know, I think for me, and I think for most writers, what really affects you is what you read as a child.
Right.
I think that, you know, your childhood literature can change your life. And so I read a lot of fairy tales and folk tales. And what I loved about them was that they talked about incredible things in such a matter-of-fact tone. It's like anything could happen at any time. And what I didn't really realize then was how that they're all very psychological stories, and they're all telling you kind of the inner truth of what it means to be human.
A lot of them are violent and disturbing. Isn't that odd? Think about it.
A lot of life is violent and disturbing.
I know, but think about what we're introducing. This is the thing that that I think is interesting about fairy tales, how children are very accepting. I mean, in some ways, maybe they teach kids how to fear in a safe way. Does that make any sense?
I think that's so. I think what you said is exactly right. I think they're cautionary tales to warn you of what could happen, you know, when you run into a wolf on the road. And I think that children accept these things. I think they understand, you know, a lot of them, you know, who the evil stepmother is and who, you know, how important it is for very much, often the stories are about a girl that finds her way alone.
That's right.
And a girl without a mother very often.
Wonder why.
Tales.
Why?
Because I think it's everyone's worst fear, both as a mother and as a child. And so what happens? How do you survive that kind of loss?
The other thing that I hear in the way you're describing this is fairy tales teach kids to trust their instincts, right? Because you said who the bad witch is or who the bad stepmother is. That's the development, isn't it? To begin to trust those voices and those instincts that tell you this isn't good.
Absolutely. And, you know, the people who say that girls are passive in fairy tales, when you think about, you know, the girls that sleep for 100 years or 20 years in a tale, it's not really passive. It's the time that they're kind of becoming, you know, becoming a woman. And I think that, I forget the statistics, but I read somewhere how many fairy tales have female heroes. Mm-hmm. And it is a lot. Almost all.
So you've given me a new way, I guess, to think of Sleeping Beauty. I do think of that as a fairy tale that's very passive. And it takes a handsome prince to come wake her up into her life. Well, I don't know. If that's not passive, what is?
Well, I think it's that. Well, I think that's about, you know, becoming a sexual being.
Yeah.
And I think it's that very often you're kind of in a state like kind of, I'm not saying comatose, but you're in a state of girlhood before you become a sexual woman. But, you know, the other thing about these fairy tales is that very often they were rewritten by men.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it's true, by the Grimms and other men, because really these fairy tales originally were stories that were told by grandmothers. There was a female oral tradition.
Right.
And then when they were collected, they were mostly collected and published by men. So things changed.
Okay. This makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so was your grandmother telling you accepted Russian folklore and fairy tales, or was she telling you like real life stories from her life and you were mixing in, you know, kind of what you'd been reading, a lot of fairy tales?
Yeah.
How did this happen, I guess?
Well, also the way she told it, it was like a fairy tale. You know, there we are in New York City on a bus and she's talking about, you know, being on a river where the men go away for months and the river freezes, and it felt like her reality was a fairy tale.
You mean as a kid?
As a kid, it felt that way to me.
But it wasn't.
No, that was her. That had been her childhood.
That maybe was how she retold the story to herself to make it.
I think that, I don't know. I mean, I think that was the way she perceived her childhood. And that's probably, you know, things change so fast. You know, she came from such a rural place where there was nothing to New York City, you know, mm-hmm. the kind of the refugee story. And I think I just couldn't believe where she had come from.
You know what's interesting about that is we all do this, right? We tell ourselves, I mean, families do this too. This is the story of our family.
Yeah.
And part of becoming an adult is starting to, I think, challenge the idea of the story of the family. And then older adulthood, I mean, I'm experiencing this now, spending a lot of time with my dad who's been ill. Retelling the story of the family, and as an older adult being willing to accept some of that?
Well, I think as you get older, you see things very differently, you know, and I think the way you perceive things as a child, and then as you get older, you kind of understand some of the people in your family who seem so strange to you as a child.
Who are you thinking of?
Oh, no one in particular.
Come on, do tell. Now, what about, so you read a lot of fairy tales. What about mythology?
Yeah, and I read a lot of mythology.
You did?
But I really mostly read science fiction. I mean, as I got older.
Wow.
Science fiction and fantasy, and I was a huge Ray Bradbury fanatic.
Huh.
And I just think he's the writer that everyone should read when they're 12 or 13.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Why?
He built such a moral world. He really is writing fantasy, but he's really writing about good and evil in the world. And I think when you're that age, you kind of need a moral compass, a moral voice. And I think he's that. He's also just a brilliant writer, but I think he's also that.
There's a sense of the theological in this novel, and I think in some of your other novels. And now I understand a little more in hearing you talk about the moral authority that Bradbury brings to this. What's your interest in that as a writer in this stage of your career?
Well, I think, you know, for me, I'm always trying to figure things out. I always feel that I'm writing the book for myself because I need to know something. And I think especially now more than ever, I'm really interested in good and evil. I mean, I guess I was when I was 12 and 13, and I still am.
In what way today?
I never had writer's block until 9/11, and then I couldn't write. And luckily for me, I went back and read Fahrenheit 451, which many of you know and love, which is about a society where books are considered so dangerous that they're burnt by firemen, and that people love books so much, they become the book, they memorize the book. And when I read that book, I felt like I could write again. I felt like I felt how important it was to read. And I feel that, you know, that's kind of where I found out everything. That was kind of like my education was the library and my mother's bookshelf were the books that I found.
When you talk about the power of the book, and we still live in a era where kids are refused certain books.
Yeah.
It's kind of mind-blowing, isn't it?
It is mind-blowing because I'm a huge fan of public libraries, and I feel like I found my whole life in a public library. And part of the reason was because I could do whatever I wanted. Nobody could tell me what to do. Nobody could tell me what to read. And that, I think, is kind of the joy of finding books in the library.
So I'm curious about your theological education and upbringing. Can I ask what your... No?
No, you can ask.
Oh.
You can ask, but I don't really have an answer.
No, you may not ask that question.
No, I felt like I had no religious upbringing, but I had a cultural upbringing.
So how does that differentiate?
It means, you know, your life is very concerned with being Jewish, but it's not concerned with religion per se.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
It's more of tradition, culture, education, what you read, your moral life, all of those things.
So your philosophical and theological development was not necessarily happening at the services
you
were going to.
No.
But it was happening how?
I think it was happening through my family, through my grandmother. You know, the year that she died, she was still volunteering at an old age home. You know?
Wow.
That was my grandmother.
In her 80s?
Yeah.
And that tells us what about her value system?
Yeah.
I
think it
tells
you everything about the way she lived her life and what she thought was important. And so that was my education, really.
So when you think about the questions that you're asking about good and evil today...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How different are they than, I guess, some of that awareness and those questions that you were asking as you were first becoming interested in the idea? You know, there's something primary and basic about some of the questions we ask about that.
That's true.
But I'm interested in how you think about it.
Well, I think right now things are very confusing, and I can only imagine what it's like to be 12 right now and to try to understand what is happening, you know, what truth is, what good is, what morality is. I think it's very, very confusing right now. And I'm kind of glad that I'm not a child at the moment because I think everyone should be given Ray Bradbury's book.
I think it always feels like that question is so complicated in the moment in which you're living.
Yeah.
There's like a tendency to say, well, during the civil rights era, I clearly would have been an upstander and not a bystander, right? That's
right.
The story we
right.
tell ourselves about ourselves. But the complexity of this is it's hard to imagine what to do to be an upstander that makes a difference or
right.
expresses your own idea
right.
about good.
That's really true. That's one of the reasons I think I wanted to write about the Holocaust, because I felt confused about what was going on, and I felt somewhat hopeless. you know, for me was really important was to talk to people who were survivors of an incredibly dark time, years after it had happened, child survivors who are now in their 80s and 90s, and to see how they kept their humanity and what, you know, how they managed to survive. And I think I was really writing because I needed to see kind of light in the darkness.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting decision, though. But it makes sense. But I need light, so I'm going back to the darkest, one of the darkest moments of,
that's
world
exactly
history.
And I was so honored to be able to meet with survivors and to... I knew there was darkness, but what I really discovered was how much good there was and how much hope there was and how much faith there was. And that was the real surprise for me.
We should probably tell the story of how this began, which you tell in the author's note.
Yeah.
If we can.
Yeah.
You're at a book event.
Right.
I was
at a library.
Yeah.
Of course.
At a library.
In Florida, and there was a woman waiting for me after my talk, and she was in the parking lot. She was an older woman, and she said, you know, I need you to write my life story. And I said, I don't do that. You know, I don't do things like that.
Were you kind but dismissive?
I don't think I was dismissive. I was just saying, you know, I'm not really even writing for my own life story, so I can't write your life story. And then she told me she had been a hidden child in France, and I'd never heard of that. She said she had been brought up in a convent and that her parents had brought her to this convent so that she would be saved. She was Jewish. And that she felt that if I didn't tell her story, it would be forgotten. I thought about it and thought about it for years. I thought about her waiting for me outside the library. And, you know, at first I felt like I couldn't tell the story because it wasn't my story.
Mm-hmm.
But then I thought, when I was in school, I was really lucky enough to have a professor who, a lot of people tell you when you're starting out as a writer, write what you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he told us, write what you can imagine, which was extremely freeing. And I thought, I can imagine it. And I started to write it actually in November of 2016 is when I started writing the book.
What do you think she meant about if you don't tell the story?
I think that's the purpose of stories. I mean, I think people do forget unless you tell the story. And I know, I mean, I never learned about this in school. And
the hidden children.
Yeah. No.
No.
I knew nothing. I really knew nothing about France during the war. I had just never learned it. I do think that it matters when you tell a story that things survive when you tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And just like in Ray Bradbury, when those people became the book.
Yes.
So that even if the book was destroyed and burned, it still lived. So I think that's what she wanted.
It's a big responsibility to... I mean, even though it was a request from her, and obviously she put this in your hands and because she believed that you could tell the story the way she wanted it told.
Yeah.
It's still a huge responsibility to take on.
Yeah, it was very scary.
What did you, in this time that you were thinking about, can I do this, what were some of the questions you were asking?
Well, you know, I try not to think too much because I think that really holds you back as a fiction writer.
What?
I really do. If you thought about everyone you ever knew reading what you wrote, you know, like, for instance, I had a friend who, like, she couldn't write her novel because she was afraid of what her mother would say. I'm like, well, then I don't know what to say, you know? And actually, she wound up writing it and then cutting out the pages before she gave it to her mother. But you can't really worry about what people are going to think if you're going to really write.
Okay, that said, that's the abstract, except for your friend with the mother. I mean, you know, your audience is kind of abstract. This is somebody who you may never see again, but she put a gift in front of you that didn't seem like a gift at the beginning, but ended up being a gift. Or did it? Maybe I should assume
that. Oh, I think it was
that.
A huge gift.
Was it?
I'm very grateful to her, yeah. Well, one of the things that was very helpful for me was I talked to a lot of survivors. And when I finished the book, I traveled through France with a historian who was a French historian who had been studying the fate of Jewish children for the past 17 years, whose day job was to search for mass graves. So I felt like
if he
thinks the book is okay, then it's okay. So I sent it to him, and he said he never thought about the Holocaust in the way that I wrote about it, but it allowed him to see it in a different way. And he was very positive. And then I felt free once he had read it.
Yeah. So when you're doing the interviews with the survivors, besides the detail, what else are you listening for?
I didn't really want the details because I didn't want to write their lives. And I never thought of really of it as interviews. You know, we got together, we had lunch, we had dinner. You know, I felt like, to tell you the truth, I felt like I was listening to my grandmother again. And for me, that made me very happy to be in that kind of situation. And actually, I saw one survivor last night, a woman named Sarah Miller, and her son and daughter-in-law said that she was so happy that she felt she was kind of living on through this experience.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
So I feel very lucky.
So when you say it wasn't the detail, because, of course, you were not telling a story that took place inside of a concentration camp or something, and you were looking for the light, what kinds of experiences were they sharing that gave you that sense of that humanity that you were looking for?
Well, there was this one survivor, just an incredible man named Peter Gossels. He was 5 and his brother was 3. They were sent from Berlin to France by their mother. And there were these children's chateaus. I read about it in the book, where Jewish organizations kept these children. They never saw their mother again. And actually, he invited me to Passover dinner. Well, he was an incredible man. He survived. He and his brother were sent to Boston to live in group homes. He went to Boston Latin. He went to Harvard. He went to Harvard Law School.
Wow.
Just an incredible person. And he invited me to Passover. And he still had the Haggadah, the Passover book, that his mother had put inside his suitcase. And I just felt like so privileged to be in the presence of someone who had experienced such gigantic loss and who was just an incredible person.
And so how in your conversation does he describe to you about making sense or living with the loss and the knowledge?
You know, a lot of times people don't speak that directly about it, but the fact that he took out the Haggadah that his mother had sent him, and, you know, that it was wrapped so carefully and that he had taken such care of it since he was 5 years old, really kind of said everything to me.
Again, though, have you ever had an experience like this as a writer where people are giving you maybe the most essential thing about themselves?
No, I've always avoided people, to tell you the truth. I really have.
In
general and in work. Because
really?
I felt like I wanted it to come from my subconscious, not from, you know, it's not like I'm sitting at a diner listening to someone's conversation.
Yeah.
I'm not that kind of writer. This was different for me. You know, this was a different experience for me. And I don't know if I'll ever do it again, but it was just a great experience for me. And I think like a singular experience. You know, most of these people, they're in their 80s and mostly 90s, and they will disappear soon.
Right.
You know, and their stories will disappear. I think what I wanted really was kind of just to be with them and to kind of almost feel what they were feeling. I think that's what I wanted, the emotion of it.
You know, you kind of hesitated when you said that, feel what they're feeling, because
I know, because it sounds so crazy, but I feel like almost, you know, when you're with someone, you can kind of like feel what they're feeling sometimes, you know, and that's how I felt when I was with these people.
I think I read an interview where you said something like, you find it difficult to, this was like years ago, you find it difficult to live in the human world.
No, I don't find it difficult, but I prefer books. Sorry. I mean, I do. You know, I'm a reader. I was a fanatical reader, and I always think that, you know, it's a very small step from being a reader to being a writer. And maybe it's just that there's a book that you want to read and it's not on the shelf, so you have to write it. And I think what you do as a reader is what you do as a writer. You know, It's so interesting to think about. You read someone else's work and you imagine the world as a reader. You are doing the work to imagine the world.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, I think it's the most interesting.
It's like nothing else out there like it.
Yeah,
right.
I agree.
But still, I think it's interesting to hear you say being of the world, in the world, is not the place that I usually draw my writing energy from.
Well, I think there are people that use their real lives, and there are people who want to escape their real lives.
Yeah.
And I think I'm the kind of writer, I'm not writing about my own experience. It's not an autobiography. I'm not writing about my parents. I'm writing about an imagined life.
Most writers say that, but...
Do they?
I mean, a number of writers do not like it when readers come up to say, okay, come on, this is autobiographical, right? No, it's fiction. That's what the whole idea is.
Well, I have written so many books. If it was about my life, I would have had
to have
30
lives.
Not
saying it was about your life. No. Also, this thing that you said about it's a short step from being a reader to a writer.
I think that's true.
Do you?
Yes. Very true.
Why? There's a whole lot of us who love to read who could not do what you did.
I just think that when you love books and when you love reading, it's not that hard to take the next step and to write.
But how about to write well?
Well, I can't
like Alice
that.
Hoffman writes, right? Is that what you told yourself? That what was the very first novel? How old were you in that?
Oh, well, the first thing I ever did, and this was completely insane, I was in high school and I wrote a story about the end of the world. I didn't use any capital letters in my story. And for some reason, I sent it to Esquire magazine, and I had never read Esquire magazine. And I got a handwritten note back, which was incredible to me. I think I was probably 15. And it said something like, when you're tired of this kid stuff, send us another one.
Really?
I am a kid.
Oh, my gosh.
So I kept that letter for the longest time because I felt like that person thought I was a writer.
I asked you to read this excerpt.
Yes. There's a daughter and granddaughter named Leah, and... she's basically being sent away from Berlin. And so this is what happens when she's being sent away. To say goodbye is a terrible thing, made even worse when you don't know why you're being sent away. We can't give up, Bobesh, she whispered as she hugged Leah. Their embrace lasted a long time, long enough for Bobesh to tell Leah the story of the last wolf in her village. It was the middle of winter when the whole world was white and a wolf and her cub had been chased as far as they could go. There was no escape, at least not for both. When the mother wolf ran to attack the hunters, all they saw were her claws and her fangs. While they shot her, the cub disappeared into the snow. That was the moment when its coat turned from black to white so that it was forever after invisible to hunters. That is the way a mother triumphs, Bobesh, she said. All you have to do is survive, and your mother lives through you. Leah kissed her mother, nothing more. She did none of the things that she wanted to do. She didn't lock herself in the closet or throw her suitcase across the room. I will always love you, her mother said, wherever you are. Leah knew this was true, but Bobesh, she had told her a harder truth. The wolf turned white in the snow. It managed to live, but it went on alone. She was in the hallway with the stranger, her suitcase in hand, and it was difficult to take a breath because something inside her chest was burning. But she went down the stairs, and she didn't look back. Do not cry, do not weep, do not beg, do not demand, do not ask why. Do not hold on to her waist. Do not throw yourself upon the floor or hide beneath the bed or lock yourself in the closet and spit out words you will regret. Pack your bag, kiss your mother, and know that what she has done for you. Kiss her again, that's fine, and tell her you will miss her. You can do that too. And then turn around and walk out. even if you hear her crying, even if your heart is telling you not to go. Her triumph depends on this. Her triumph is you.
That's the first part of my conversation on the stage of the Fitzgerald Theater with writer Alice Hoffman. We'll get a look at the latest news, and we'll be back with more of our Talking Volumes conversation.
You're listening to Talking Volumes at the Fitzgerald Theater with writer Alice Hoffman. Her new novel is titled The World That We Knew, and I'm Carrie Miller. In hearing the beginnings of your career and knowing how long you've been writing, I was curious about whether you have written your way out of self-doubt. That you... No?
No.
Why? Why not?
I always feel like when I start a new book, I don't know how to write a novel.
Really?
I have to learn the whole thing all over again. But I think that's what makes it interesting. I mean, it's always new. It's always fresh. It doesn't feel old to me.
But it also doesn't feel frightening because you know that you will remember how to write a novel. You've done it before. You can do it again.
Sometimes it is frightening and I don't feel like I can do it. Sometimes I can't do it and I write half a novel and it doesn't work. And I have to do a different novel. I mean, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. It's funny because I'm involved with this teen workshop, and I went this summer, and this very serious boy, he was a junior in high school, came up to me and said, I've been working on a novel for 2 years. I thought, wow, okay. And he said, and how do I know it's going to be published? And I said, you don't. That's the whole thing about it. You're writing it because you love to do it. You have to do that because it may or may not get published.
How did he react to that?
He didn't say another word. I don't know. He was taking it in.
Have you ever read Edna O'Brien's work?
Yes.
So she was here for Talking Volumes years ago. I mean, writing for, at this point, 45 or 50 years. Uh-huh. And I asked her kind of a version of, now you know what it feels like when it's working. She was like, never.
Well, I just think, you know, part of what keeps things fresh and exciting is that it's dangerous in a way. You know, it may work, it may not work. And that's what art is all about. You know, you're putting yourself out there, you're trying it, but you're not, like I told this kid, you're not assured anything.
What's happening when it isn't working?
You know, I feel like you just know. You just know. It's kind of like a love affair. You know, what's happening when that isn't working? You just know.
Yeah, but what else?
There is no... I mean, I think, you know, if you feel like you're taking your characters and you're kind of picking them up and moving them around, I feel like there comes a point where characters kind of take on a life of their own.
Uh-huh.
And they make their own choices, and they feel like they are having a life. And you're following them, basically.
Uh-huh. So it's like when the reader can't see me working... in some mm-hmm. ways, as the writer, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Is that right or not?
Well, I think it's more for me as the writer when I feel that I've created a world and now there are these people who live in it. And I may think I can tell them what to do and I have an outline and I think I know what's going to happen, but ultimately they're going to make different choices. They're going to come alive.
Do you outline?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Have you always done that?
I think so. I can't remember to tell you the truth, but I do outline.
And why?
Well, I think it gives you a place to go. Even if everything changes, it kind of gives you a place to go so that you're not there with kind of a blank computer screen. You feel like you know where you're going.
Is that what it's really more about? Like, I have a blueprint.
Yeah.
I may not follow it at all.
Right.
It's like a security blanket in some ways?
In some ways it is. I mean, you think you know where you're going, but if it takes off, it starts to change.
How closely does the blueprint resemble what ended up becoming this novel? Do you know?
I would say about a third of it is gone.
Meaning in the revisions or in the writing?
In the revisions.
Okay. And have you gotten pretty philosophical about, I'm killing it off? That's what it takes.
No, it's very hard to do.
Is it?
I think it's hard to do. And sometimes you have to get rid of the writing that you love the most, but it just doesn't work as a whole.
And you don't say to the editor, no, these 90 pages must stay.
You know, if you're working with an editor that you feel that way about, you probably should get a different editor.
Right, that you can argue and persuade.
You know, you can argue, but really, I mean, I think the point of working with an editor is to have like this other voice that you then consider and really look at it almost as if it's someone else's work.
Mm-hmm.
Because what's the point of arguing if it's not working?
Right. But maybe sometimes it takes someone else to tell you that it's not working.
I think it does.
I'm also interested in how you think about the idea of survivorship and how that's changed.
You know, it's really interesting that you said that because I realized at some point in my career that's all I write about is love and loss and survivorship.
Wow.
And I think I started to really, it was evident to me when I'm a breast cancer survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to write about that. And I felt like I was going to write about it forever. And actually, my oncologist told me, you know, okay, first your main character will have cancer, and then it will be, a kind of another side character, you know, not that important character. And then it will just get farther and farther away from you. And that's true, but I'm still writing about survivorship in one way or another.
But you've said you always have.
I think I always have.
What do you think your preoccupation has been, even as a young writer, it sounds like, with this?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's all of our preoccupation, pretty much, really, I have to say. I mean, when it gets right down to it, what else is there other than love and loss and survivorship? That's it.
Such a happy view of
well, there's
of
love in there.
Yeah. So how do you think your perception of survivorship changed having come through breast cancer, having had that experience?
I don't know. You know, it's a big question because really, you know, there's like a before and an after.
Right.
You know, when you get a diagnosis and you have to kind of prepare to die. It's so funny that as humans we don't think about that all the time. But when you get a diagnosis, then you have to start to think in a different way.
And then it's like all you can think about, isn't it?
For a while. For a while, yeah.
Right.
And I think that it gave me a different view of survivors in general. And I became more attuned to what people go through and manage to go on living and manage to lead good lives and be good people. I mean, that to me is just a huge human mystery.
The mystery is
how people managed to survive.
How people came through something deeply traumatic.
Yeah.
And rearrange their lives to say...
And still had hope.
Yeah.
And still wanted to be alive and still thought the world was beautiful.
So do you feel like, let's say you hadn't had the experience with breast cancer and you hadn't confronted some of the things that you did, do you feel like you would have come to those conversations with the Holocaust survivors in a different way or as a different person?
Well, you know, I always felt when I was talking to them, I am talking to them as a granddaughter, as someone who can never know what they experienced, but who wants to learn as much as I can and know as much as I can.
But I guess what I was asking you is, having had your own experience with this, that isn't obviously the same as theirs,
no.
But having, you know, confronted your mortality at some point in this, did that bring you into these conversations with a different perspective?
I mean, that's an interesting question. I think every part of your life, you know, everything that you experience leads you to where you are now, you know, both the great things and the traumatic things. So it's very hard to know, you know, who you would be if you hadn't experienced certain things.
Right. But this was obviously not a conscious, I know in some ways how to have these conversations.
No, it wasn't conscious. I felt like I was going as a student. I was going as a daughter. I was going to learn.
That's a wonderful place to be at a...
It was for me.
At a certain place in your life, isn't it?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about Toni Morrison, because I know you're a great admirer of hers, too.
I really am.
I was reading this Paris Review interview, and I wondered what you thought of this. I've seen this in some other interviews with her, but she really expounded on it in this Paris Review interview. So the interviewer asks her if she writes to figure out what she feels. Mm. And she says, no, I know how I feel. You can just hear that too, can't you? Toni Morrison saying that. My feelings are the result of prejudices and convictions like everybody else's. But I'm interested in the complexity and the vulnerability of an idea.
Well, I think that's very interesting. I mean, I do think she is the greatest American writer. And I was lucky enough, I saw her, she gave the Norton Lectures at Harvard. I think it was either last year or the year before, and I went to see three of them. So
wow.
Oh, I was
my
so
gosh.
Lucky. And she did say that she always started with a question. And I thought, I always start with a question. Why didn't I write Beloved? She said that when she wrote Beloved, and I thought this was so interesting, she read a small article about it, about a slave who was tracked down and had a child and so didn't want her child to be taken back that she killed her.
Yes.
And she said she didn't do any more research because she didn't want to be touched by other people's opinions or other people's take on the story. She wanted to create it. She wanted to then imagine it. Wow. And I thought, you know, I think that's what a great writer does, is that they reimagine the world.
Right. I think what I hear saying in this thing, in this idea, is that she doesn't want to be certain. Well, this actually kind of mirrors what you've just said. She does not want to be certain about things. She wanted to be open to the idea that the idea was vulnerable, that it could change, that what she thought about it wasn't necessarily the last word on it.
Yeah.
That's really remarkable in a world where certainty is like the coin of the realm,
well,
right?
I think when you write, you discover things you didn't know. And I always think that the writer is usually smarter than the person, and that you know things as a writer that you don't know in your day-to-day life.
Yeah. Okay, the writer is smarter than the person.
Yeah.
But then how do you make sure that you're not imbuing... You mean the character?
Not the character, the writer.
I mean, no, but I think, you said the writer is smarter than the
person.
Yeah,
I think what you know... I think if you can get to your subconscious self, you know more than you do when you're just walking around with all your protection and all your armor and everything else.
How'd you figure that out?
I've read my book.
Right. Now, at what point do you think you began to really understand that?
I mean, I think it's pretty recently that I...
Really?
Because I think so many times I wrote a book and I felt like sometimes my readers would know more about what the book was really about than I did. Because I think when you write a book, there's an outer story and there's an inner story. So you know the outer story, you know what the plot is, you know who the characters are. But the inner story, the psychology of the story, sometimes it takes a long time to really understand what you've written and what you mean.
What if you don't know what you mean?
I don't think that really matters.
Right. If that isn't transparent.
If it's not transparent to you as a writer, it may be to a reader. You know, books mean different things to different people, I think.
That's what makes what we're doing difficult, isn't it, for writers? To try to enter into the psychology.
Oh, well, I think it's, for me, this is my opinion, but I feel like as a fiction writer, to be overly intellectual about your own work is a mistake, because you're not the critic, you're not the scholar, you're the writer. And if you think about it too much, and if you delve into it too much, I think you can kind of kill it.
I mean, that's why I was kind of like, but that's what this is kind of all about, right? Trying to plunge into the psychology of Alice Hoffman as she wrote this amazing novel. And
to some extent, but you know, really, I think it's, the book's already written, you know,
yeah.
So it doesn't really matter. But if I were working on a book, I wouldn't want to discuss it in these terms.
Right. How well have you kind of punctured the inner story of this novel as much as you created the outer story?
I think I understand it now. For myself, I understand what it means to me.
What does it mean to you?
That's my business.
You were just waiting for me to ask that. Or what?
Okay, why though? Why is that your business and not ours?
Because I think, first of all, I wouldn't want to affect a reader's feeling or sense of a book, because that's private and personal, and that's their experience, intimate experience with a book. So I wouldn't want to tell someone what to think.
Okay, you said first of all, like there was more.
Well, then maybe there is, but I can't think of it right now.
So you feel like if you are too revealing about that inner story, it will change the experience of the reader.
Yeah, I think it's. I think a reader's experience is very personal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't think it's. You know, actually, my professor always said to me, "The writer isn't the person that you meet; it's the person you read."
Wow.
So I believe that.
Would you read another excerpt?
Sure.
All right. And perhaps tell us a little bit about where we are.
Yes.
In the story.
So in the story, Leah, the granddaughter, the daughter, is sent away with a magical, mythical creature to protect her called a golem. And they travel through France together. So they're in the woods together in this section that I'm going to read to you now. They were so well hidden that Ava, that's the golem, allowed Leah the freedom to wander. She was going for water from the nearby stream when she saw a wolf, just as Bobeshi had when she was a girl, not much older than Leah was now. At first, Leah thought that it was a dream that she had never woken from, and that she was likely still sleeping, curled up under the bushes. But she reached down and pinched herself, and the pinch stung, and she knew she was awake. And then she was certain that what had happened to her grandmother was now happening to her. The wolf was black with yellow eyes, and it was said that such creatures had been hunted to extinction in this region, that they'd been shot and hung on posts, murdered one by one by hunting parties. But some things cannot be destroyed so easily. Leah lifted her eyes to look into his. He had been so quiet, she hadn't heard him approach, though she should have known. There were no birds singing, and the leaves refused to fall. She had to stay alive. She had made a promise. How to do so was the question. "Don't run," her grandmother had told her. "Do not be afraid. Be who you are, and know that he will be who he is." How many wolves were left? 3 or 4, half a dozen? Or was it just this single wolf watching her from the edge of the stream, ready to leap if she was the sort of human who had a gun or a knife or an eye for murder? Soon enough, he saw she was just a girl sitting by the stream. They were themselves, and they knew each other, and they could feel one another's loneliness. When you are a wolf, no place is safe. No one can be trusted, unless they are what you are, hunted. "Hello," Leah said. Her voice sounded hollow and pure, and the wolf came towards her. "We were wolves in the forest, chased until there was nowhere to go. When you are not considered human, you learn how to run." He was bigger than a dog and ragged, and Leah was motionless. And when he came close, his breath was warm, and he smelled like grass, a sweet, deep, dark scent of the woods. He was not young, and he was weary, for he had seen enough of men to last him a lifetime.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. You can learn more about our show by searching for NPR News with Carrie Miller.